Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Flimsy stand slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armadillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo, built to last, designed to impress.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Li Ho Fook's. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein. Werewolves of London. Of London.
Welcome to Free State, everybody. Our guest today is Gary Stevenson, whose book, The Trading Game, is honestly the best book I've read this year. It's an extraordinary story. Gary, you're very welcome to Free State. We're going to get into this, but I just want to ask you, first of all, The Trading Game, it says it's called The Trading Game, A Confession.
Yeah.
Why is it a confession?
We had some very fraught arguments about this in the Penguin office. I think what we wanted to get through is, this is not, you see the cover and you might think this is going to be a book about finance, this is going to be a book about trading. This is a story-driven book. This is about what happened to me. This is my story from growing up as a poor kid, kicking footballs around lampposts in East London, to being Citibank's top trader in 10 years by betting on the collapse of the economy. And why I quit. And what I really wanted to do, I don't really read a lot of non-fiction. I read fiction.
How much did you make in those 10 years?
I made enough. There'll be food on the table if I ever have kids.
And you were actually, you became the top trader.
2011, I was Citibank's top trader globally, yeah.
And what age were you then?
I turned 25 at the back end of that year.
And at that stage, you were betting on, everyone else was betting on economic recovery.
Yeah, this is my second stage. So my first stage as a trader was having no idea what I was doing and copying everyone, which is my sort of first era. And then it's realizing that the economy is totally fucked forever and betting on absolute disaster and becoming phenomenally successful. And that's what I was betting on in 2011. I guess that's probably the sort of defining moment of my life, defining year of my life in a way.
You look now like a trader. Say, like, if my mother was here, she would make you a hot meal.
Yeah,
you're like a whippet.
Well,
just for the listeners, he's wearing tracksuit bottoms, a wee black t-shirt, battered trainers.
Yeah, you know, people on my YouTube, there's a conspiracy on the internet that this is like my fake image that I put on. I'm acting like I want to pretend to be the Artful Dodger. This is I've always dressed. This is, you know.
But when you were betting at that stage, I want to go back to your beginning at some stage. But you were betting then, and you had this. There's this. Fantastic moment where you look around and you realize that where the money is going, and you're looking around the Citibank.
It's us, isn't it?
On the 42nd floor
of
Citibank, and you're looking around and you realize, well, okay, if the money is going here and it's the government is putting this is after the bailouts,
and
the money is going into the government is giving the banks the money and it's not going to the people, where is it going?
Yeah.
And you realize, you look around, you see the guys in their pink shirts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you realize that this is where it is. This is where the balance is.
It's really the Wolf of Wall Street. I mean, this, the most striking sentence, I mean, that stopped me in my tracks. You've never written before.
No,
I
mean, no.
Was I spent my first week on the credit trading desk, approximately 1 year and 10 months before that precise desk would blow up the world economy.
Yeah, it's a true story.
It's, you know, and I mean, we'll get into it more, but it's, I mean, the book is hilarious, and you know, there are times, I mean, I was in court, I was reading it in court, you know, in the middle of a case. So I'd say, are you ready for cross-examination, Mr. Billy? Oh, yes, quite, Your Honour, you know.
I'm glad.
Hello, how are
me.
You today?
I wanted it to be, it has to be funny, because this book, in a sense, is about the collapse of our economies and our societies. And if it wasn't fucking funny, you couldn't fucking read it, mate. And if, listen, I had to do the audiobook for this. I did the audiobook a couple of months ago. And one thing, towards the end of the book, it gets very sad. And one thing that impressed me about young Gary was he never lost his sense of humour. And I think when you're going through difficult times like we are now, if it's not funny, you can't fucking get through it.
It's the wildness of human greed, you know, and it's the, you know, I think, you know, part of it is, like, you know, you as a young fella coming up from nothing and seeing these sort of shining towers of money and thinking, fuck, I'm going to make sure that I lead this extraordinary life. And then discovering when you were in it, that it was, that it was a bubble, that it was a, you know, in a way, there was a lot of, I mean, it was, in a way, a lot of the worst qualities of human beings come out there, because you're cut off from the outside world, really. It becomes...
Mate, these skyscrapers, they cast shadows on our houses, mate. They block out the sun where we live, you know. So they're ours, and we want to get in them. And that was, you know, the first part of the book is me. How do we get in there? How do we get into those skyscrapers?
Because Canary Wharf was built as you were growing up.
We saw it, Yeah, I always remember when I was about 7 or 8, one of my mates in primary school gave a talk about there's this new skyscraper, and if you want, you can go walk around the top. And you know, we saw them going up. We saw them going up, and they were aspirational for us.
And there's a wonderful image in the book where you go, when you're on that 42nd floor, and you could always see, you could see it obviously from where you grew up. And you go and try and see if you can see your house.
Yeah, I was so young. I just this very childish idea, which is like, you know, I'm on this skyscraper. Let's go to the top and let's see if we can see our house. And the very top floor, you might think the fucking CEO lives there or something, but actually it's an event space. So when there's no event, there's nobody there. And it's just, it's weirdly beautiful, actually. You come out of the lift and all it is just this vast expanse of blue carpet with these windows. And I went to the window and, you know, you look for your house. But then you're like, I can't see it. And you realise... I can't see my house because it's blocked by the next skyscraper. It's behind the next skyscraper. And this is beautiful irony, right? Which is when we were kids, we look up at these skyscrapers and then I'm in the skyscraper and I can't see my house because it's blocked by the fucking next skyscraper. I think the line I use in the book is the ambitious young children of East London look up to the skyscrapers, which cast shadows on their houses, but the skyscrapers don't look back. Yeah. They look at each other.
And that's it. And that is the story of the book. Like, you're trading, and we'll get into this, like you're doing... currency FX swaps, and like you're doing you're huge sway over currency and people and interest rates and people's lives, and like you're dealing in, like, you know, Swedish currency. You've never been to Sweden. So it is that again, you're speaking to each other and the people below are just irrelevant.
There's this total absurdity about this, but there's such humor there. And I mean, the people who I worked with, the guys who I worked with, they're just insane. I work with these, and it's.
I think the phrase you used was absolute nutters.
I mean, it's a gift to a writer, like this, like Rupert. This Rupert, this public school English sort of rugger bugger. He's sort of, and I think I describe him in the book as looking as if he was unexpectedly dropped off at boarding school at 6 years old and not picked up until he was 21. And this is kind of.
That made me laugh.
These guys are just. But they're. What I don't want to. I really didn't want to do this Wolf of Wall Street. These guys are all dickheads. These guys are all villains. Mm-hmm. What I wanted you to do is see what I saw. Because what I've got a lot of affection and a lot of love for these guys. Even guys like Rupert and guys like Caleb, who you might describe as the villain of the piece. These are young men who wanted to be something. And this is what the world does to these people.
That's what I was thinking, that, you know, like any, you know, especially somebody from your background, very driven and all, you know, you want to discover the world. Mm. There's a very, so you want to see how the world works. And then once you discover how it actually works, it's a deeply depressing experience.
Yeah, this is the story of the book in a way. It's like, you know, you want to be something, you want to be something, you want to be the best that you're, you know, I'm sure you guys are the same, you know. You want it to be the best in the work that you do, right? And then you want to climb to the top of the mountain, and then you want to see what's happening. And then when you see it, what you see is horrific. And then what do?
I suppose also, see, like, you had no context, you know. You don't sort of address it, but you didn't seem to have a very happy home life, you know.
No, this is kind of floating around the background.
There's a part of it we say about, you know, when you'd made your first big bonus, the 395,000, that Christmas, your family bought presents for you, but you didn't buy anybody presents yourself.
Yeah, you know, this is...
Or that sense of, so I suppose whenever you're then going out into the world, you really are going out yourself. Like, it was like Dick Whittington, you know, getting his belongings to go to London.
But, you know, I think every young man, there's a big discussion in this book. It's not explicit, but about ambition and what drives young people, in particular young men, but not just young men, to be the best. And we, you know, I come from London. We lionize ambition in our society. But I think when you look at the most ambitious young people, often there's something behind the scenes there which is a little bit dark. Otherwise, why are you not happy just to be a good father and a good employee and make enough money? Why do you need more? And it's this... I worry a little bit about the message we send to our young people. Go out, be the best. Especially, you know, out-compete everybody else. Be the best. Take everybody else down. There's a kind of... There's a viciousness and a violence beneath the surface. And I think I want to sort of dig beneath this, like, stereotypical Wolf of Wall Street stuff and say, what actually is driving these people? You know what I mean?
I mean, there's the intoxication, like, the exhilaration.
It's a drug. It's an addiction, 100%.
Of making the money, and especially, like, you were so young and you were able to make trades of, like, 100 million, like, by, you know, in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And, you know, another one of the things that comes across really forcibly, I'll just go back a bit just so the listeners can get the context. I mean, you didn't come through your sort of, you weren't your Oxford, you weren't coming from Singapore, from a public education or anything like that. You managed to get one of these prize trading positions.
Yeah.
Because you won a competition.
Yeah, card game.
You want to trade.
This is the title of the book, The Trading Game, is the card game which I won my job in, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a matchless description of how you did that.
Yeah.
And how you, you know, it was poker, and I won't spoil the finale to the story because I was so deflated reading it, because I thought, he's going to win this now. He's gone through to the final round. Mm. Everybody's watching him. You know, this is like, you know, Mike Tyson against a statuesque heavyweight, you know, who's learned the rules and respects them.
Yeah.
You know, and you think these posh boys have no chance, and then you're so deflated.
Yeah.
Initially. Yeah, and I don't want to spoil the punchline about that.
A game is played on me. I think this, so the card game is a kind of, it's a really nice microcosm of the thing in itself. So first of all, I was studying at LSE. So I was expelled from school at 16 for drugs. And then I don't have a school for a year, and I spend a year like lying on the floor doing maths on a wooden board, and I managed to kill all my exams, and I managed to get into London School of Economics despite being expelled from school. And I was a very good mathematician as a kid, and I assumed, like a lot of young people,
where did that come from? Did your folks, was there anybody?
The maths thing. Nobody in my family's ever been good. I don't even know.
Your parents were Mormons, were they?
My parents are Mormons, yeah. My family were all a little bit weird. I don't know if there's some, I don't know, they're on the spectrum or something. Yeah, well, but this maths thing...
Join the coup.
But were you, because one of the themes of the book is that you're an outsider kind of in this world. But were your parents outside, like today?
I mean, I was an outsider. So I grew up in Ilford. Ilford is a very, very South Asian area. So I went to schools which would have been, I went to a few different schools because I got expelled in this, which would have been somewhere between 70% and 90% South Asian. And the one which was 70%, most of the white kids were like kids of bankers, because that was a grammar school. And my parents are Mormons, obviously. So I was never sort of the normal kid. I was always a bit of a weirdo.
But the maths thing.
Yeah.
You know, maths is impenetrable to me. Okay. You know, and, you know, there were times when you were, everyone should read this book. School pupils, this should be part of the education system, because our kids don't know anything. They don't understand how the world works.
Yeah.
you know, I became latterly very friendly with the head of global equity at Goldman Sachs. He's an Irishman who, like yourself, brilliant with numbers.
Yeah.
He was in the Irish Army, goes to UCD in a scholarship, picked up by Goldman Sachs. Now he's at the top of the tree. You know, that's sort of $100 million. And, you know, it's very like your story. I mean, but what I'm fascinated by is this instinctive thing about mathematics. I mean, you could just see it and see it quicker than anybody else.
I've always been a bit like that. I used to, I won a couple of competitions when I was a kid, and everyone at school would be like, we know you're studying, but like, I'd bring it to my house. There wasn't a fucking desk in my house. I would just go into competitions and just win competitions. So it was very intuitive, and it was quite visual, like you say. It was quite visual.
Yeah, try and explain that to me. Like if you saw a numbers maths problem, I mean, I was struck by how quickly you dominated the top generation of numbers people in the competition to get into.
The best way to explain it, it's a weird thing. It almost feels as if there's a guy in the back of my head that passes the answer forward. It almost feels like it's out of my control in a way. So I need to look at it. I do sort of visualise it for a bit, but you just sit with it, you think about it, and someone at the back sort of passes, here's the answer, and then you have to kind of work backwards. How did you give me this answer? It is strange, and it's always been strange, and I don't know where it come from. No one in my family has ever had this.
But you see it. It's almost like you just see it.
Yeah, there's definitely a visual element to the way. I mean, I haven't done maths since I was sort of really at university, but there's definitely a visual element to it, and I don't know. And I think maybe people think that's amazing, but it's, to be honest, it's weird.
It's a very original story, and you know this. I thought there were some comparisons with The Wolf of Wall Street, with the hero in that, because no more than yourself, you know, he came up from nothing.
Yeah.
But one thing that you had, regardless of troubles at home and expulsion and a very thriller childhood and all that, was this, I'll call it enormous confidence, but an absolute sort of focus on, you know, getting to where you wanted to get to.
Yeah.
You didn't know where you were going to get to. And the part of the book that again, so much of the book is brilliant, was that when you got in there, you realized very quickly, and it's brilliantly described, once we're saying, most of these people haven't fucking clue what they're doing. They're pretending they know what they're doing. They're dispensing billions of dollars from Citibank.
Yeah.
Lorenzo Di Luca.
And really, I mean, one of your, I'm just going to read this short passage, just remind you. So you at this stage were sitting at the trading desk beside Snoopy. And you said, like, most of them knew nothing. I knew that Snoopy knew nothing. And Snoopy knew that I knew nothing. I knew he shouldn't have been there. He knew I shouldn't have been there. We both knew on some deep instinctive level that we were surrounded by absolute nutters, and it was important that no one found out. We were stowaways on a pirate ship headed towards buried treasure.
That's what
an incomparable paragraph of writing, like, and but it pervades the. I mean, you talk about Chuck when Chuck came in.
Oh my God, Chuck, and it's kind of revealed at some point, but Chuck. So Chuck is my boss quits, and we were like, who's the new boss going to be? And there's this absolute giant, he's about 6'8", massive guy, enormous stomach, like muscle, like a lumberjack kind of Canadian guy. And everyone's like, he's going to be the new boss. And there's these rumours going around, will he be the new boss? And the way that I find out he's the new boss is, so at that time, I was kind of desk junior, so I have to stay behind and do a little bit of admin work, blah, blah, blah. And everyone's gone home, and this guy Chuck comes over, this giant, comes over, and he's like, hi, how are you doing? I'm like, all right. Yeah, I'm fine. He sits down next to me and he just sits there just smiling at me. I'm like, just doing my work. And then he pulls out of nowhere. He pulls a copy of Sports Illustrated from behind his back and just opens it to me, just shows me, and just starts wiggling his eyebrows at me and says, yeah, you like that, don't you? I'm like,
it was a picture of
a woman in a bikini, obviously, it's Sports Illustrated. And then he just goes,
is that all they have in that?
Goes through the whole
swimwear issue, come on.
Goes through the whole magazine, women in bikini, like 20 women in bikinis.
I missed the swimwear issues.
Yeah, you were buying it for the interviews.
Yeah. But and then and
you
then
said
I knew,
you said about him, you know, and the impression you had was that he was very, because in a way, you, foxed him into giving you the Swiss.
Yes, this is the thing. He shows me 20 women in bikinis, one at a time. And on about the seventh or eighth bikini, I realised this guy's probably the new boss, because otherwise this is even more insane. There's no other explanation. And then after the 20th bikini, he stands up and he says to me, "So what's your job then?" And I was thinking, like, surely this guy knows he's about to be our new boss. And then I had been covering for the previous boss because he'd quit, and he was a Swiss franc trader. So I was covering Swiss francs, which is quite a big job, actually. Yeah. And I just assumed the new boss would be the Swiss franc trader. And here he's asking, "What's your job?" And I can't, there's this moment where I look at him and he looks at me, and he's this giant and I'm, you know, quite a small guy. I think, all right then. And I just say to him, "I'm the Swiss franc trader, chap. I'm the Swiss franc trader."
I believe you.
Yeah, and he looks at me, and to this day, I don't know whether he was just a bit of an idiot or whether he just loved the balls of it. And he was just like, "All right. Nice to meet you." And that was it. I became the Swiss franc trader just because I decided to tell him I was.
And explain to people what being the Swiss franc trader means.
So everyone has we're doing loans and everyone has their own currency. And if you get your own, so if you get euros, which is everyone trades against the dollar. So no one is a dollar trader. If you get euros, basically it's a ton of free money because all the customers come in, some borrow, some lend, you know, you lend at a low rate, you lend at a high rate, you borrow at a low rate, you take the cut in between. And if you get given a currency, the biggest currency is euros, then pounds, then in Europe, probably the Swiss franc. It's free money, basically. And I, at that age, was 23. So to be given Swiss franc was massive.
And that was the first trade that you had where you just decided you were going to go for it and you got your £395,000 bonus.
Yeah, so the previous boss had told me... When he quit, he was like my big sponsor. This is Caleb. He's like the big sort of antagonist of the novel. He's in the opening scene of the novel. He kind of represents banking as a whole in a way. He hires me and then he quits after 9 months. And he's like, "I'm sorry," but he takes me out for lunch. He says, "You can ask me any one question you want." I say to him, "What do I have to do to get paid 100 grand? And for me at that age, 100 grand was like the most money I could imagine.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I was 22, actually, 2009, 22. And he was like, "You can't make 100 grand. And I was like, "Tell me." He goes, "You need to make $10 million for the bank." And I was like, "All right, simple." I went back and I had a list of trades that would make me $10 million. But I couldn't put them on because I didn't have a currency. You need to be the trader for that currency. And then as soon as I got given Swiss franc, I was like, boom, we're going on. And I think the context you need is that...
Now what was that first trade?
I think I lent $1 billion for 1 year of against the Swiss franc.
And what you call a billion, what, a yard?
We call it a yard, yeah. So in European languages, milliard means a billion, and it's been replaced.
Like you,
but everything, but that's kind of part of the process too. Everything is removed from its context.
One of my favorite small passages of the book is there's a little passage. It's almost a poem about the hypnotic power of numbers, which is where just after this trade, actually, where I'm trying to make $10 million and I'm counting $1 million. $2 million. And my life, my actual life is going on around me. I meet my first serious girlfriend and she's in the mate with my car and I meet her in Shoreditch in East London. And then Gordon Brown is like talking about taxing the bankers. There's $3 million, $4 million. And then I'm hanging out with my girlfriend. She lived in Kilburn, Northwest London. I'm buying my mate's car, $5 million, $6 million. And it's the way that when you as an individual allow yourself, you know, maybe you find the same with sport. When you have this one thing that you're in, you're locked in, you are, everything around it seems to kind of fade into the background and you become obsessed with this thing. And it's, on the one hand, it's a very powerful thing. And without that obsession, I would never have been as successful as I was. And I probably wouldn't be doing, to be honest, writing this book was the same. I was obsessed with the book when I wrote the book. But it's, at the same time, it can be phenomenally dehumanizing when it's just about the numbers and everything else fades into the background.
Yeah, there was and you're right about that, like, but my obsessions were short-lived. I mean, my obsession was to win an All-Ireland, which is the equivalent of the sort of soccer Champions League, you know.
Yeah.
And I went through that like we won it in 1983. I was 22. It was a blur. It's still a blur. I never watch it. I never look back. But once that was over, I'm standing in the shower.
Yeah.
Like this, the cold winds of anticlimax.
Yeah, I was going to ask you this because this is a big thing. Like for me, in the this first... the big bonus is, I never enjoyed them.
I wanted to come to that. Well, that's why I told that, why I was talking about that.
Because you, so, go on.
Stop interrupting, that's so rude. Can I just apologise? No, he's always interrupting me. Yeah.
You're doing a great job.
This is a joke, because the times when I get to finish a sentence are quite rare.
Relatively rare.
Don't be so disloyal. See, I've told you before, never speak outside the family. So anyway, it's the part, and I wanted to ask you about this because this is why I thought that, and I do think this book should be on the curriculum for our school children.
Yeah.
Because it begins to let them see how the world really is.
Yeah.
You know, the way our mainstream media report the financial markets, etc. It, as you know, bears absolutely no resemblance to what's going on in there.
Yeah, yeah.
But you get 395,000.
Mm-hmm.
You're shown the piece of paper by the boss. There's your bonus.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll just read the part of the book.
Yeah, go.
You go home. Your girlfriend's there, and you don't tell her. Because you don't want to tell her. You know, there's something about this that's not right. And, and deep down in you, it's just not right. And in the middle of the night, you hear her crying.
Yeah.
And she says to you, you know, so like, you don't trust me. Why didn't you tell me? Yeah. Why didn't you tell me what the bonus is?
Mm-hmm.
And you're stroking her hair and trying to calm her. I hadn't really decided who I was going to tell. I told her. She stopped crying instantly in a moment. You know, she looked very much like a young child. Her eyes seemed to grow until they became enormous. I could see the whole circles of her unmoving irises. Straight away, I wished I'd never told her. A few months later, we broke up. And you described them being in your mate's house. And they're joking, what did you get, Gaz? Did you get a bonus? I decided in the moment just to say it. I got £395,000. You could feel it, the oxygen leaving the room. Things were never the same after that.
Mm.
And there's something about the enormity of it. And, and also maybe the deeper human feeling of, you know, 395,000 for that, you know, and people, you know, kids starving in the world. And, you know, my dad laboring for 20 grand salary all his days.
Yeah.
Like a cold wind passed over you.
But it's such a mad thing because you have this very strong feeling like this should be good and it is good. This is everything I worked for. This is everything I wanted. And the context you need is obviously I thought it was going to be 120 grand. It was 400 grand. And But then there's this really deeply human part of me, which I didn't really understand. You know, I talk about, I get the bonus and I'm shocked. And then the next scene, and this, when you write a book like this, you're patching things together from memory, but there's some things which you remember like they were yesterday. And I remember this, receiving this first bonus. Then I remember being on the desk and feeling like I was going to cry. And I was still only just turned 23 at that time. And, but of course it's absurd. You think like, what the fuck am I doing? Why am I? And then Billy, who's kind of my like scouse trading guru, comes around and he's like, go sit outside. Sit outside. You'll feel better. And you sit outside and the first thing you think of, I think of my dad, how hard my dad worked. You know, he worked really hard and he used to go to work at 5 a.m. and my mum used to wake us up and we used to try to wave to him on the train. The train went past the back of the house and he'd get back like late at night and he's always tired. 35 years, 20 grand a year. And then you getting paid 400 grand basically, you know, for playing a computer game. And you think of your friends and your friends' dads. And then, but then at the same time, suddenly then there's this other voice, which is like, well, if you made 400 grand, what did Rupert make? What did Billy make? What did those dickheads in the pink shirts make? You know, why are they allowed to make money? Not people like me and people like my dad and people I grew up with. And then, and there's this, it splits you in a sense because there's this human part of you that knows that it's wrong. But there's this other part of you that is like, well, why not me? And I suppose that's, in one sense, that's a voice of justice, but another sense, it's a voice of greed. And there's this, that sort of starts the internal battle.
It's the power of the addiction, because it's a surprising way, you know, how you manage to break away from it, because it's that, you know, your instant, you described sort of the human emotions of this, the shock really, and the deep down, you know, the unsettling feeling that this is all is not well here. Yeah. It might seem to people to be great, you know, it's like the lottery winners who take their own lives, you know, that sort of thing. And you've got this reaction of, well, I'm now going to make $10 million. I'm going to make $100 million.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do. And the sense, reading the book of, in a way, because like I'm twice your age. I was like, what age are you now?
37. You're probably not quite twice my age.
I'm not twice. You do look very, very young. But it's the sense of a human being getting lost in this.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm glad you took that because that is how, but you don't know you're lost at the time. It's kind of these, and it's very confusing because everyone around you thinks Gary's so successful and you yourself are aware that you should be happy. You almost have this guilt. Why not happy? And it's this sort of trying to figure it out, trying to sort of pick out the threads and try to understand. It was very confusing time.
When you're telling your friends from the outside that what you've got and you see your girlfriend's reaction and then the other part of you is thinking, what has everyone else got?
Yeah.
Are you then being pulled more into that world where you think, the only world... I don't feel right in either world, but the only world I can really exist in is the one where everyone is trying to make money all the time.
This is the thing. I go back and I read these parts of the book when I received the first bonus. And it's quite sad in a way, because at the time I was very confused, but I can look back now and I can say very clearly, like, he's experiencing a shock reaction. I experienced a shock. It was a very shocking thing. And I wanted to share that with my girlfriend. I wanted to share that with my friends, but I knew that if I say this to them, it's going to totally change. They are going to have received the same kind of shock that I received, but from the outside, and it's going to separate us.
Yeah, it's sort of, your description, you don't say it, so maybe you could talk a bit about this. It seemed to, in a way, repel your girlfriend. It seemed to, do you know, like, you say, you know, we broke up very quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What was it, do you think, that drove her away then?
I think as soon as it puts this, it's that amount of money to somebody, and she's not from a very different background to me. She also grew up quite poor, you know. There's no way to describe what it is other than shock. But then there's no place for me to go after that other than forwards, because at this stage, that's my first year trading. And I know I can, like, kill that. And I know I'm better than the guys around me. And I know I can do it. And I know I hit that. But I know I have to go forwards. There's no other place for me to go. But I've seen, I saw the way that it affected her. And I just, I knew somehow we're separate now. I have to go forward, you know. And I knew I couldn't speak to her about it. I knew there was no, we couldn't start talking about these things in a normal way because it was such an inhuman amount of money. But I knew that my job was not complete. I mean, it's hard for me to say because I was so young at the time. It's just, you're at the start of a thing and you know it's going to separate you from everyone, but you know you're not done and you have to go on alone, in a sense. It's hard for me to describe.
Who can I turn to when nobody needs? My heart wants to know and so I must go where destiny leads me. No star to guide me and no one beside me. I'll go on my way and after the day the darkness will hide me. Maybe tomorrow I'll find what I'm after. I'll throw off my sorrow, beg, steal, or borrow my share of laughter. With you I could learn to, with you on a new day. But who can I turn to if you turn? No star to guide me and no one beside me. I'll go on my way and after the day the darkness will hide me. And maybe tomorrow I'll find what I'm after. I'll throw off my sorrow, beg, steal or borrow my share of laughter. With you I could learn to, with you on a new day. But who can I turn to if you die?
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.